This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you very much. As the last speaker just pointed out, 30 years of doing this with Rob. I think any endeavor that goes on for 30 years is an amazing thing. I didn't get involved with coming to Pinball Expo until either the second or third year, when my friend Larry said, we need to go to this thing, you need to come see this. And it was a much smaller event back then, but it was astonishing to me that people would actually show up and want to talk about pinball machines. To me, pinball machines were something you went and you played, and you know, and that was that. I had no idea, you know, that 28 years ago, you know, why people would think this was so important that they had to have a giant group of people come do it. So it's amazing. And by the way, Rob, I fought my way into the trading card line, and all of yours are gone. I tried. They weren't there. I usually start this off by asking the members of the audience, how many people here are operators? Is there anybody here who's an operator? God bless you all. The way this industry has changed over the 30 years, you know, this show started out where you had a tremendous amount of operators that came because they were interested in what their games were doing and, you know, what was going to happen and who was what where. And pinball has become a very hard sell on location over the years. And anybody who's done this for any length of time understands the difficulties of that, you know, for the operators. And so to anybody who still operates these games, I'm deeply indebted for my livelihood, and I appreciate what you've done over the years. As do, I'm sure, the people in this room who got to play games because of you, and I think you deserve a round of applause from this crowd, too. The other thing I try and do when I come and do this is I try and ask the audience, how many people are here for the first time? Wow. Wow, is that great? How many people have no idea who Pat Lawler is? There, see? Good idea. If we get younger and younger people, I'd have like the whole crowd go, "Who's that guy? You know, what's he doing?" I have an interesting story I'll share with you before we get into what I'm going to do. And by the way, I'll let you know what I'm going to do right away. So if it sounds tremendously boring, you can like head out and have lunch and do whatever you need to do. I'm going to show you the making of Banzai Run, which was my first game in the business with Larry DeMar. And I'm going to take you from the beginning to the end, and you'll be able to ask questions while I'm showing you these slides. But we'll get there in a minute. And then when we're done with that, we'll do a typical Pat Lawler. You can ask me, you know, almost any question you want, and I'll be glad to try and answer if I can. And then that's going to segue into Larry's program, which is the making of Banzai Run. Apparently, we didn't know what each one of us was going to do when we were getting here. He's got a much bigger show. He's got 2 hours to go, so I'm going to try real hard not to totally step on what he was going to do. I've got this thing that was enlightening for me. It was like a sort of revelation that I hadn't thought about in a long time. A couple of years ago, for those of you that know, for the last year, I've been working with Jersey Jack on an original game, and that's, thank you very much. And by the way, I'll tell you, Jack's here, I'm sure, and Jack's told this story. There he is in the back, and it's okay for me to tell this story. Jack and I had talked. I don't know if you know this, but when Jack started his company, those guys rented a building from me in Harvard, Illinois, which is where Pat Lawler Design had been. And I was just a landlord. That's all I was doing. I rented the building to them, and they came, they set up shop, and it was really pretty good for them because it was turnkey. It had my whole machine shop was there with all the machine tools and, you know, lots of space, and they could do what they wanted to do. And Jack kept calling me, and he'd say, besides, you know, when I was bugging him for something his guys had blown up or destroyed or whatever, we would talk, and he would say, why don't you come do a game? Why don't you come do a game? And so finally, a little over a year ago, I said, okay, we'll talk a little bit. And then 1 week over three phone calls, like literally 5 hours of talking on the phone, he was trying to convince me that I should come and work and do an original game. And I kept telling him, no, that's stupid. In this day and age, with just collectors pretty much being left, you only want to do a licensed game. And he was, no, you're wrong. You need to do a Pat Lawler game. And I was, I think the only thing that's left that people want to buy is Spider-Man. And he convinced me. Okay, he convinced me. So one way or the other, one of us is going to be right. we're both going to be right. I got to tell you, you've all been coming up to me here at the show. Thank you very much for all the well wishes. Thank you very much for for your support on what we're doing. I can't tell you how painful it is if you're a game designer to have somebody walk up to you and keep handing you licenses. It's incredibly painful, okay? You're standing there and you're saying, let's do something over here, and somebody's handing you a license saying, no, we'll sell this. And so it's really nice. It's really refreshing to get to do that again. And in true Pat fashion, when you finally get to see this, you'll understand why it's another right-hand turn. So you'll get that next year. And I really can't go into much more than that, but you'll get that next year. And we're having a great time doing it. And usually if we have a great time, if we can make ourselves laugh and smile, that means we can make you laugh and smile. And so we're looking at getting there. The story I wanted to tell you really quickly was a couple of years ago, before I hooked up with Jack again, I was working, I'd been working with my wife at Hyper Stitch, which is her business. And I was doing the technical stuff that needed to be done for screen printing, among other things. And it was a nice break. I was burned out. It was a nice break. I got to do something completely different. I got to learn a whole new craft that I had only barely thought about before then. And I looked on the internet, and I saw that Stern was having one of their coming out parties at GameWorks here in Chicago, and I thought, oh, this would be fun. You know, I'll drive down to the coming out party for this new pinball machine. I'll see some of the people I know, and I'll sort of hang around. And so I got in my car, and I drove down to GameWorks, and I got there a little early. And for those of you that don't know or never been to a GameWorks or seen a GameWorks, it's a huge arcade. It's just gigantic. When you walk in, the good thing about GameWorks is they have they not only have the games, but they also have a liquor license. So you can, if you get there a little early to do something, you can get a beer, and that's a good thing that I can sit down and do that there, because if you're my age and you're walking around an arcade by yourself, you look like that new Rob Lowe commercial where here's crazy Rob Lowe, right? Okay, and like people are taking their kids and shuffling them away from the crazy old dude. So I went and I got there early, and they do those things. They have an upstairs there, and the Stern guys were setting up their games, and they were busy, and I didn't want to go bother them. So I sat at they have a bar upstairs there in that area, and I sat at the bar, and I had my back to the guys who were setting up the games, and I was you know, I was chatting with the bartender, and I think there was some sporting event on TV. I don't remember. And this young guy came, and he sat down next to me, and he was about, I don't know, maybe 22, 23 years old. I was just, you know, sipping on my beer, and he leans over to me, and he says, hi, do you know anything about pinball? And I thought for a minute, and I turned to him. I said, I played it when I was younger. And he was very excited. He was one of you guys. Okay, he was one of you guys. This was his hobby, and he had gotten in his car and he'd driven there and he wanted to see this cool new Steve Ritchie game. And he then proceeded to tell me everything there was to know about pinball and Steve Ritchie, his hero. And I was nodding my head. Yeah, and some of what he said was true. There was a lot that wasn't, but some of what he said was true. And by that time, the Stern guys had gotten their games together, and he got up, and he like ran over, and he got to start playing games. And the reason I'm telling you that story, besides the fact that I was having a good time listening to him, isn't because I want to be the American Express guy, right, who's, you know me by my card, right? It drove home the point for me that what this hobby is about people who really get into what they're doing, that they really, really want to know everything there is to know about, you know, the game business and what we do and how the games are made and, you know, where they come from and all that kind of stuff. When you do anything for a living, when you do whatever you folks do for a living, you know, every day you come home and you think to yourself, oh man, another day at the office, you know, I'd do that again. And it's fun to see other people enjoy what you do. You know, it's fun to do that. And it drove that home again. It sort of reinvigorated me to what it was we did. So it was a good thing. What we're going to do is we're going to show some slides. We're going to talk a little bit about Banzai Run. I'm going to tell one of the reasons I'm doing this, by the way, before I get into this, is right now out on the show floor, there are all kinds of brand new companies, and what they're doing is they're trying new and unique and different things. Okay, they're showing you video monitors in a playfield, and they're showing you different visions of what they think pinball could become. And I want you to understand by seeing ancient history that how hard this is. Well, I'm going to, you know, this is a joke that the people in the business all know. And if they've lasted longer than a few years, they know it well. How hard could it be? How hard could it be doing what we do, right? I always say this, you guys get to see the finished product. You guys get to see when we're all done doing what it is we do. You know, we get to see the sausage being made, right? And so it's really easy to see a finished product and think, oh, well, I could do that. You know, I could do that. And hopefully in what you're going to see here, you're going to see how difficult it really is to try and do something new. For the new people who may not know some of the history, Banzai Run was the first pinball machine that I worked on. I did it with Larry Standup. Larry's going to be doing the next show after this, okay? I would not be standing in front of you. I wouldn't have been standing in front of you for 28 years if it weren't for Larry. So I'm deeply indebted to Larry. I've said that many times publicly. So what you're going to see here is Larry and Pat's excellent adventure. Actually, it's Larry's excellent adventure in teaching Pat pinball. Okay. I had worked as Dave Thiel, who was on earlier. I had been in video games, and I had worked with a whole group of people doing that, starting with Dave Nutting Associates, working my way through Action Graphics with people like Dave Thiel and Richard, and then Elaine Ditton, now Elaine Hodgson, who was here earlier. I ended up meeting a guy who's sitting next to Larry DeMar, Paul DeSalt, who worked in the business forever, and Paul introduced Larry and me. And when he introduced us, I walked up to Larry, and I was exactly as much in awe as sometimes I perceive people are when they walk up and want to talk to me. Larry had done all the cool VidKids vid stuff, and he had done High Speed with Steve Ritchie, among other games. And we had spent, when I was working at Nuvatech with Paul DeSalt, I had spent a summer playing High Speed. And for anybody who was alive back then, who was an operator or who remembers, pinball was kind of just barely coasting. It was alive, but it was coasting. And when High Speed came out, it absolutely, positively blew the arcade world and the bar world away, okay? You just couldn't imagine how cool the game was because of its gameplay mechanic. So here I was meeting this guy that was like, wow, I had been in the game business, but I'd always wanted to meet. So I walked up to him, and I think the second thing I said after I said, pleased to meet you, was, I've got this idea for a game. And I'm sure Larry's first thought was, oh, here we go. And so I had this idea where we build a pinball machine with a vertical and a horizontal play field, and you'd get to play the same ball on both play fields. And so here's what it took to do that when he said, let's do this. Okay, I live 65 miles from here out in the country in a place called Marengo, Illinois. And Larry lives in the city of Chicago, or he lived in the city of Chicago at the time. So Larry would, to start the project, he would drive out to my place. This is my dining room, and this is the first lower whitewood for... We didn't even have a theme for the game yet. We knew that what we needed to do was prove that we could build a pinball machine that was fun on the bottom, and you could take the ball up into the top and do something with it. So I proceeded to... I knew how to draw, and so I proceeded to draw a couple of different play fields, full size and Mylar. And then I hand cut these out using a saber saw and my wood tools, and built the parts that were sort of individual. But in the meantime, Larry had gone out and he had bought a game from a distributor that we took apart and took it apart brand new. It was a Road Kings. We took it apart brand new and used the parts off of that to build this. So that actually could be like the next, you know, big thing for collectors. If you're really that cool, just go buy a game and take it apart, right? That would be fun. So this is a picture that was taken in my dining room in like 27 years ago. That sounds about right. Something like that. We were both young and much more fun to look at. Next picture. Okay, here's without the two of us in front of it, and there's a couple of things that are a little hard to see but are interesting to point out. If you look at the ramp that goes around the game, okay, that ramp is made out of the same stuff that you make the ducting in your house for your air conditioning system out of. Okay, it was made out of metal. I had a friend of mine, that was what he did every day for a living. He was a metal craftsman that did that kind of stuff. And so he said, oh, no problem making a ramp. I'll help you out. And that piece of metal was made exactly the same way you make ducting in houses. It's even got rolled edges the same way. But it worked. It proved what you wanted to do. The other thing, if you look real closely up in the center, is there's only two jet bumpers. And those two jet bumpers, that was one of the first things that, like, Larry showed up and he looked at and he went, bad. So I figured out then that you needed three jet bumpers to make things good. We can do the next one. We pretty quickly determined that we needed to figure out exactly what we were going to do with the back part of the game. And in fact, one of the first experiments we did was, and I did it late at night, Larry had gone home for the day. I had rigged a couple of flippers on a backboard, and I had stood it up in the cabinet. We didn't even know how high you could flip a pinball vertically. We had no idea. Nobody had ever thought about that before. And so it's like literally 10 o'clock at night, we put a ball there and flipped it, and we shot it right out the top of the game. And we all started screaming and yelling and jumping around, and like that was the coolest thing ever. Like, this was going to work, right? But the reason I want you to look at this particular picture is that if you're starting to look at the backboard, if you see that the displays are in there in that orientation and that there's four flippers up there and it's sort of a wide open play field, when I did this, we had no idea what was going to be any kind of fun on a vertical play field. And your first inclination is, oh, I'll build it like I'd build a lower play field, kind of open, can shoot the ball anywhere. That doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. Okay, but you don't know that, and you have to go through all these. What you're going to see are the permutations of what we're learning to do in order to make this game viable, and everything you have to do to go through it. This is a long-range picture of the whole thing put together and still being messed around with it at my house. Let's see if we can. Why I got that? Oh, I saved this picture. I'm sorry, this is hard to see. If you look over on the left, now what's happened is we've gone from a metal ramp to a ramp that comes around and goes onto a wire form and drops the ball down on the left side of the game, a lot like what High Speed did when it was kicking the balls out to you. Okay. And I was starting to experiment, and you'll notice now there's three jet bumpers there. And we're still trying to experiment and figure out what's fun, what's going on. The crazy thing about doing this project as your first project was not only did I have to learn how to figure out what a regular old pinball machine would do, but I had to figure out how to build a play field in the back that would also be just as much fun that nobody had ever done. So I was building two games simultaneously, and I'm as fast as I possibly could, I was grinding play fields at night and turning them back into new things. This is just getting to see what we had done with some of the parts we had to mock that up, and it's just, it's bare bones whitewood stuff, which is what every game designer is used to doing and what you guys are never used to seeing. Here's the day that we moved the game from my house in Marengo, Illinois, to Larry's condo down near Lincoln Park in Chicago. And it was really cold. You can't see me standing there in the background, but I've got on a wool hat and all my wool clothes. And we had loaded this in what? We were on like the eighth floor. So what floor was it, Larry? Ninth floor. We're on the ninth floor. So we're like moving this crazy thing up and down, and people are like looking at us like, what are these guys doing? That was delivery day for taking it down to Larry so he could start to, make it do things. Here is a picture, and again, I apologize for some of being a little hard to see. On the left side of the game, what I started to do was I started to tinker with what would eventually become real Bonsai Run. On the left, you can see the stand-ups being moved out so that I could put a ramp over there and then run the ball back out. And up till that point, none of that had ever been there. You'll also be able to see, it's a little hard to see again, but if you see those things that look like arrows and all the funny little writing on the playfield, there's a lost art that nobody does anymore when they design pinball machines, but that everybody did who was a game designer back when I first got to Williams. And remember, we're not at Williams yet. We're still doing this in our garage, essentially. But Larry told me that what everybody did was you took rub-on letters and numbers and things and you basically rubbed them onto the playfield so that when people eventually got to see it, they could look at it and understand what was going on. So all the early game designers were used to putting things on the playfield that way just as a demonstration for the people who were going to look at their games. The question is, what was my conception of when you drained from the top onto the bottom? And the concept always was that the ball would be put back in play in the bottom. The patent that was finally issued for the game to the two of us was that it was a single ball. Later on, we'll show you, when we got to Williams, there were people who were hammering on us that this was stupid. What we should do is just put a ball up there and put a ball at the bottom and not have to go through the trouble of lifting one ball up and back. And we were adamant that the cool thing you were doing was getting to move the one ball between the two play fields and play them. Go ahead. Okay, here is a view of a play field that's being put together at Larry's. You can see the little bulldozer on the left because I had settled on a theme called Wrecking Ball. I thought it would be cool if you got to do this construction theme. Imagine that. And you took the ball and, you know, we could put bulldozers and you'd run what the original game does is in the alphanumerics, it says run the crane and wreck the game. we were getting there, but we still had the same back box because I didn't know what I was really still up to there. Go ahead. Sorry, that's a hard picture. Larry's standing next to the game. The good luck bear is on the right, and Larry's brand new computer is sitting there. What was that? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It was one of the first. That was a very expensive computer, by the way, in those days. That was a very expensive computer. Go ahead. Here's what we ended up. We're getting to the point where we're getting ready. Larry had contacted the people that he knew at Williams, Ken Fidesna, and eventually Neil Nicastro. And Steve Ritchie were going to come, and they were going to look at what we had done and decide if they wanted to buy into the project. And so here's kind of the final version of that bottom on Wrecking Ball. So there's the bulldozer and the yellow on the side and pretty much how the play field ended up. And you can really see how the final version of Bonsai Run came out of this. Okay, the bottom we could pretty much set in stone, but the top was yet to become the problem. That's me and Larry. That's the afternoon that we were getting ready to show the game off. And we both had champagne, and the reason we had champagne was because, oh my God, we finally made it this far. And it was pretty cool. Okay, Williams Electronics Games, Ken showed up, and Steve Ritchie showed up, and Neil Nicastro showed up. And they looked at it, and they kind of shuffled around, and they weren't sure what they wanted to do, but they believed in Larry a lot. Remember, Larry had just gotten done doing High Speed with Steve. And so they said, okay, we'll do a deal. And a couple of months after everybody worked it out, they said, okay, Pat, come on to Williams and you can help finish this project. Once you get to Williams, real stuff starts to happen. And by that I mean there's like a real game team. There's a mechanical engineer who I would later end up doing most of my, or if not all of my games with, John Crutch. And John's first problem was figuring out how do you build the cabinet so that you can hinge the back box so it goes down with all this garbage that this guy wants to put in here. And so through John's genius, he had to sit there and he had to figure this out. And this is before the days of drawing in CAD/CAM. John drew this cabinet full size on a drawing table that was 6 feet long. Okay? This entire cabinet was drawn full size. It was sent out, came back. Here's the cabinet, and I'm standing in the back hallway at Williams next to the cabinet. Okay, here's an upper playfield that I was literally turning out an upper playfield about once a week because we were trying desperately to figure out what's the most fun thing you can do with this upper back box thing that we had created. The dynamics of playing a pinball machine straight vertical are completely different than playing a pinball machine anywhere else. Almost all the good shots are an immediate backhand off a flipper because that's where the real power stroke on the game is. But we had to learn that. Okay, it's not intuitive. None of that is intuitive. See, what you can see there is these are mock-ups where I've got a lower set of flippers, and I'm learning how do you do what you want to do. So on the right, you can see the backhand shot. On the left, you can see there was actually drop targets in this version, and you were going to knock them down, and then it was going to go up to the next level and get fired up to those flippers. The problem with having drop targets in a vertical playfield is they're no fun. They're no fun, okay, because you're trying to get the ball higher and higher and higher, and you're running into a wall, and you don't want to run into the wall. You want to go higher and higher and higher, and it just is no fun. There's no fun there. But again, just like the guys in the other room, we were learning, okay? You're on the fly. You're trying to learn. You're trying to figure out what'll be fun for people to do. Here's another version of what we did with the game, and now it's broken into quadrants. That's a little bit more like real Banzai Run, but, you know, not so much. I still have drop targets. That's not right. The right-hand lower side is okay. The upper side actually starting to look like Banzai Run, but that thing on the right side never quite worked. In the final version, it never quite worked the way we wanted it to, and at this point, it was becoming, you know, apparent that you couldn't use the entire back playfield for somebody to play. We also had to figure out what we were going to do for the bottom play field for the whole insert structure on what the rules were going to be and what you were going to do with the, you know, what was this game going to be? We needed a theme. The powers that be at Williams at the time determined that Run the Crane, Wreck the Game was a bad idea. Okay, they didn't like the whole construction thing. And so now everybody's sort of thrashing around trying to come up with a theme that'll take this game and turn it into something. And one of the art guys at Williams, Mark Springer, showed up in Larry's office one morning with drawings for Banzai Run. And he said, this would be cool. It's a motorcycle thing. And I didn't know that much about motocross, and I don't think Larry knew that much about motocross. Steve Ritchie knew about motocross, but he was angry about the whole thing. So we sort of said, okay, well, that sounds kind of interesting. We can go with that. But if you look at the inserts, there's what would eventually become inserts from F-14 Tomcat, right, in there. But if you look at the left side of the playfield, you see that arrangement of inserts with the center? What game did that end up on? Who knows? Perfect. Okay, we don't ever waste anything in this business. I really liked how that looked, but I had to bide my time to use it. Here's another version, and this is the version sitting in Larry's office at Williams. On the left, you see all the drawings plastered to the wall that I kept changing and throwing up there. Imagine being the poor programmer on this project. Every 3 seconds, some guy's walking in with a brand new playfield going, well, I think this works. I think this works. But in this version, you're seeing that what John Crutch has done is he's starting to figure out how he wants to move, use the lifter to get the ball up the playfield and raise the ball from the bottom to the top. And in John's genius, he decided that the way he was going to do it was he was going to use a screw, which was exactly like the screws in copy machines. If you had a copy machine and you wanted to run something back and forth, the technology was very bad for things like limit switches. So you couldn't ever rely on an object being stopped by a microprocessor and then coming back the other way with a limit switch. If the limit switch broke, what you did was you ran to the limit of the mechanism and tore it to pieces. And John knew that. Okay? I had no clue. And so what he did was he came up with this beautiful, the screw that you've all, if you've been inside a Banzai Run to see how that is, it's the endless screw, right? It just goes up and down and up and down, and it keeps turning in one direction. Again, these were things that, you know, nobody had ever had to really think about. And by the way, after we did this, it sort of became common knowledge in the world that it was a bad idea to put limit switches on things when you were trying to have mechanisms that wanted to run back and forth. You tried to make them so that they couldn't become self-destructive, you know, because we were sort of trying to keep the operators in business. Here was a big day. This was the day that the artwork showed up for the cabinet sides. And a lot of people don't know this, but cabinet sides in the business are and were originally done on Masonite. And so what they'd do is they'd screen print these test panels for us and send them to us on Masonite. And so I literally at my house have these wonderful Masonite panels for like most of my games. For the cabinet sides. I always wanted to save them and put them up as a rec room decoration. But we got those and put that up, and that was a big day. We got to see the artwork. Here is the finished whitewood of what was going to be Banzai Run. And again, you see how we used these rub-off letters on the bottom to be able to do dog and pony shows for the people internally at Williams when they'd come in and want to see what we were doing. So they were there. The layout for the inserts was there because now Larry had come up with a set of rules which would work. And that's that right there, you're looking at what a real finished whitewood looks like. Go ahead. Another big day in the history of a project. This is the build-up room at Williams. This is where your first 12 games were put together. And so they would show up with the cabinets and they'd set them up like that, and then they'd piece by piece begin to put them together one at a time. And that's how the first 12 games were ever done. For you people who are hardcore collectors, when you see a game that has X something, something, something in the serial number, the X means that it was one of those. Going to show you how hard it is for the art guys to figure out what they're doing, and Larry's going to show you this later, but basically, if you're looking at the top of this game for what we were doing for the art people were having a terrible time trying to figure out what they were going to do with this little back glass and to go with the rest of the cabinet. And so the first back glasses were done. Go ahead. The first back glasses that were done were blue instead of brown. And it didn't match. The whole idea was that you had gone up the hill and that was the sky, right? Only it didn't work. It was a great concept, but it sort of didn't work. And so they were all busy shuffling around trying to redo back glasses. And again, we have I think we have 12 of those that are in existence, okay, with the funny colors and all that stuff. This picture, by the way, is a huge day when you find, if you're a game designer, this is a big day for the game team. Okay, this is the day when you get to take your game on test for the first time. And so we were in the arcade before they opened, and this was our top secret test location in Rockford, Illinois. And we used that location for another, 6 years, and nobody found out where it was and what we were doing there. There's a really cool addendum to this picture. Does anybody besides Larry recognize who's sitting on the stool facing the game? It's Ed Boon, who was later to become Mr. Mortal Kombat. And he worked on the game with us. And I've got another great picture of him in a minute. Go ahead. This is the guy who put the first money ever in a bonsai run. He didn't know it. He was like really unhappy that we were taking pictures of him. And we're all standing around getting ready to like see what the game would do. Larry had this vision that in order to sell Bonsai Run, we had to be able to get $1 a hit out of you, to 50 cents a hit to play the game. It was like 50 cents and three for a dollar, I think, right? And we put a bill acceptor on the game, although at this arcade it really didn't sort of make a difference. And a 50 cents a play in 1988 was a huge, you know, was a huge leap you were trying to make. All the games were a quarter, and to try and make it 50 cents, and we had to see if the players were willing to put up the money to try and play something different. And if you're really, really, really lucky and you go out on location your first day, this is what happens. You've got a crowd of people, including the lady with the big hair there, who are standing around, and they're trying to figure out what your game is all about, and they want to play it. And so we were all standing in the background watching them try and figure out how to play Bonsai Run, and that's a really, really big deal. As a timeline, we are now a year past when we first tried starting to do this, and again, for the people in the other room, this is a very difficult thing to do. It takes time. It takes. This would not have been possible, okay, without the talented, on every level, the talented people at Williams Electronics Games, all the way from Larry to the management to the people who did as a daily thing put these games together. They just knew how to do it. They knew how to put the games together. I like to tell people working at Williams was special because they wouldn't let you fail. They wouldn't let you fail. Everybody there had been doing it for so long that they knew their job was to help the game get to the end and to work. And so hats off to, you know, all of those people. This is the next big day in the life of a game. This is Bonsai Runs lined up and getting ready to go to a trade show. And they're also starting to be built in the factory. Okay? And you're looking at the games that ended up going off to go to different test locations to go to shows, to do all that kind of stuff. That's Mark Springer. And these are the last bunch of pictures here, and then we'll grab a couple of questions. Mark Springer standing next to the game. Go ahead. There's Larry standing next to the line of games that we had managed to put together. There's Ed Boon. I love Ed. Ed was like Mr. Excitement always. He always wanted to like have things go. This is trade show. This is getting to put your game in front of the industry. There were two big trade shows every year. There was AMOA and ACME. And when you got to put your game on a trade show floor and have the people who were going to show up and actually buy it play it, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. Everybody at Williams used to fight to be the show games. Because if you were the show games, you probably were going to sell more games than you were if you weren't a show game. And there were a lot of reasons for that, but you used to kill to be a show game. Oddly enough, this picture was taken at Pinball Expo. This picture was taken at Pinball Expo, I believe, 1988 or 89. I don't know which one. Probably 88, Larry? Yeah. And we always laugh about this picture because we always say that Ed Boon always looks like his dog died when we take his picture. That's why I showed you the picture with him being Mr. Excitement. There's me standing by the game when it was all done. And oops, you can't see it. This is the last picture. Every year, the amusement operators used to vote on a set of awards. And they used to give awards for the most played video game, the most played pinball machine. Banzai Run won the award for the most creative new game of the year. And that was a big deal, by the way. So again, from soup to nuts, getting to do all that, you can see how hard it is, how difficult it is to do what you need to do. So what I'm going to do now is, just like we used to do with the Pat Lawler Show, you don't have to ask questions about Banzai. You can ask questions about anything, and I'll be glad to answer you. It looks like we've got 10 minutes. So I will take questions until you're tired of me, and then Larry will come on and do his thing. Sir.
I'm new to the hobby, and the very first machine I ever bought was Roadshow. I was hoping to give you some interesting tidbit or a little story that most people might not know about.
Sure. Roadshow was... Most people don't recognize, but there is a sort of common thread from Earthshaker to Whirlwind to Funhouse, to skip the next two games, to Roadshow. Okay? If you look on the play fields, they start to reference each other. And it's my version of going across America. And we did Funhouse with Rudy. And by the time you get to Roadshow, there's a reference Red makes in the game about her brother who works for the circus. Okay, which is Rudy. Also in the backs of the playfields, if you look real close, there's like interstate markers and things that are sort of showing you where the games are going. And by the way, the programmer of Roadshow is sitting right there. Dwight, stand up. I feel bad because I almost killed Dwight on Roadshow. I mean, just with the amount of work, there were too many dummies. There was too much going on. Yeah. Next question, sir.
I'm curious about the insight into, like, when you run 12 prototype games in your own contest, what you change if you might have made the game from that to production. I have one of the 12 games, one of the external numbers, and I put it out on the internet to all databases, and those are documented. I documented the changes that I see.
Specifically on Banzai Run, I don't recall a lot of what we did at the end. Every single game I ever worked on at Williams, and I mean literally every single game I worked on at Williams, you would go out on test and you'd see things that you hadn't seen with the games in-house. And you'd basically have to go through and make changes and at the last minute be taking parts off and putting on new ones and you know, removing parts from holes. And then when you got to production, the play fields would catch up, the art would catch up with what you were doing and like that. Bonsai was unique in that, you know, there were a lot more parts. And so it's possible that we saw, you know, that stuff had to be moved slightly or bumped around or whatever. A lot of that happens, too, because the guys who manufacture the game, the manufacturing people, would finally get it on the manufacturing floor, and they'd be having trouble getting their tools in where they needed to go for something, and they'd ask, can you move this light over, you know, a half an inch, or can you do this thing over here? And we'd, you know, engineering would pick up the changes and try and get them to do what they were doing.
Just real quick, you had earthquakes and whirlwind. Why was it you were using those themes, nature things, Mother Nature things? What made you pick that of all things?
The question is, why was I doing disaster themes to start with? That they were fun. The most important thing you can do as a game designer, in my humble estimation, is come up with a theme that people immediately recognize. Okay? It's very difficult to design a game with a theme where people walk up and have no idea what this game is supposed to be about. And so if I have a game called Earthshaker or Whirlwind, you immediately know what the game's all about, right? And by the way, for those of you who don't know, I invented the shaker motor, okay? the most has become the most ubiquitous thing that goes in these games now, okay? I cannot tell you the fights and arguments at Williams over the shaker motor. Okay, people who were convinced that the shaker motor was going to destroy the game and parts were going to fall out and this was going to be a horrible calamity of some kind and operators would hate us and it went on and on and on and on and on and we stood our ground and said, we're going to put this shaker motor in a game, and oh my gosh, when it went out on test, it was awesome to watch. You know, people just loved it. You know, they just thought it was great. And then we sort of didn't use it, and our competition decided it was so cool they put it in every game they ever had, which is pretty funny. But to answer your question, it's just, you know, relevance. It's relevance. Sir?
I had a quick question. The kid at the bar, did you ever tell him who you were?
No.
And did he ever mention one of your games as one of his favorites?
Oh, the kid at the bar. No. I never told him who I was. And he made me feel really old, though. I mean, I got to tell you, I was like, oh, man, how soon they forget. But I really didn't want to. I didn't want to tell him because I wanted to hear what he, you know, you can't get people's honest opinion if they're, you know, they want to do that. And I don't think he ever told me what his favorite, it must have been a Steve Ritchie game of some kind. So, you know, that was cool. Sir.
After Bonsai Run was like complete, what was the transition process for you to start doing traditional technology?
The question is, after Bonsai Run was done, how did I transition to doing more traditional games? After Bonsai Run was done, Ken Fidesna, who was the VP and general manager of Williams, called me. Because the contract I had done, or what we had done, was just to do Bonsai for me. And, you know, part of that was they wanted to see if I was any good at what I could do. And he called me up and said, we'd like to talk to you about sticking around and being a game designer. And so, you know, I was like, no, just kidding. I flew up to his office, and the lawyers worked out the details. And it, by the way, if... For, you know, those of you that don't know, the game designers were all pretty much under contract. And so we sort of were like, you know, baseball players. You have a guy who negotiates for you to do that kind of stuff. The reason for that was Williams didn't want their talent learning everything and then going to work for the competition. And so it was a way of making sure that everybody played fair. and it worked out well for everybody in the long run. Obviously, I'm standing here in front of you.
Can you tell us what was different about working in Williams versus working for Stern now and working for Jersey Tech?
Sure. The question is, what's different between working at Williams and working for Stern and now working for Jersey Jack? Working for Williams was a once-in-a-lifetime event that anybody who was in that, anybody who wanted to do what we did, you know, just would die to do. The people that were there, this is going to be the last question because it's going to take me 3 minutes to answer it. I'll be done in a minute. The people who were there were trusted by management to build fun things. Management came to them, and this was a big deal. I wanna be clear about this. Back in those days, the engineering budget at Williams was $1 million a game per team. Okay, that's 1990 money. $1 million a game a team to do. That's before you get any games on the assembly line. That's to get through the engineering and build one game. And so they had to trust you to build something fun, okay? They couldn't afford to have people there that they coddled. They treated everyone like an adult. They said, "You build something fun, you'll be here forever. And if you don't build something fun, well, we'll find somebody who can build something fun." Those were amazing times. For a lot of reasons, it's not like we didn't have our disagreements. It's not like we didn't end up screaming and shouting at each other. It's not like we didn't, you know, do what we did. But management treated you like big people, okay? They treated you like big people. They treated you like the talent you were. And as a result, the people who were there delivered in spades. They delivered to them in spades what they were supposed to deliver to them. It was a big deal. Stern is a little bit different arrangement. I can only talk about what I did at Stern. I did it as my own company, as Pat Lawler Design, because to be perfectly honest, I live 65 miles away from here. I had driven to Williams every day of my existence, you know, and I was just sick of being on the interstate every day. I grabbed my own people. I said I can design games. We decided we were going to design some games. And, you know, Stern's a different arrangement in that they do all licensing. There is no original stuff that's done there. I'm not going to say anything bad about the time I was there, but it's a different arrangement. It's just a different kind of venue. Jack, I already told you the story of, you know, talking together and saying, do what you love to do and build something fun. And there is a small, dedicated group of people there who very badly want to build something that you can all play. And time will tell. You know, time will tell. It's very difficult to be a game designer right now because the business has changed so much. It used to be that we sold over 80% of what we manufactured to street operators. Okay, everybody always goes, oh, the arcades. The arcades were a small part of what we did. It was the street operators that bought the games. Okay, the people in the bars and the bowling alleys and the convenience stores, all those places were the kind of places that coin-operated games went. Fast forward to the year 2000, and all of a sudden what happened was the collector, the people who'd been playing the games in 1992 were starting to show up with enough money to buy these games to have in their houses themselves. And pinball still wasn't making the kind of money that it used to make, and certainly wasn't making the kind of money that an operator expected it to make to pay for the equipment. And so it transitioned in the 2000s through the games being predominantly on the street and being beat up and being played for money to collectors buying the games and, you know, and putting them in their houses. And the offshoot of that, if you're a game designer, is that you've gone from get somebody to play the game for 3 minutes and kick them off the game to make money to somebody wanting to play the game for a month and not lose interest. They're two completely different products, okay, in the gameplay mechanic that you're designing. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to do. And so that's, you know, that's the challenge. That's the challenge going forward. I want to thank you all very much. It's been a great time. Have a good one.